From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, walking, dancing, stretching, which is better for your brain? We'll talk about the fact that maybe they're not all exactly the same. And fruit juice, moderation. What's moderation? Does it cause obesity in children? Some new information that talks about that cutting-edge topic.
Okay, and guest chef?
Yes, today? We've got a wonderful recipe from a guest chef. The cookbook is Let's Cook Japanese Food by Amy Kaneko. It's a wonderful recipe for salmon teriyaki. If you love salmon as I do, and if you like teriyaki, you will not want to lose this recipe. You will want to make this recipe. So stay tuned.
Let's go to the phone, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. Our first caller joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how can we help?
I have a question about my vasovagal reactions. Mm-hmm. They've happened my whole life, and it usually happens with shots or blood work, but it also has happened with bee stings and ear piercings. I pass out, and I have such severe convulsions that I've had to have two people hold me down. And when I come to, I immediately throw up, and I'm just exhausted. I'm sweaty. I can't drive. And I've talked to two neurologists. They've just told me it's something that's happened. I've tried to talk to a psychologist. They say that they can't help me. But it's happened as early as I can remember at 5 years old.
Whoa.
So I just don't know what to do anymore.
Sure.
I try and talk throughout it. I try to take deep breaths. And it's gotten so bad that I can even tell when I'm about to pass out so they can take the needle out mm-hmm. and hold me down.
Sure. Well, a vasovagal faint is basically where the vagus nerve takes over. It's a major nerve in the body and says, I'm going to faint. You've got to get down to the ground. You may be standing up, and it basically shunts blood inside to the heart, away from the muscles, into the internal organs, and basically makes you fall. That's basically what happened. And she described a classic vasovagal faint, to the extreme, by the way, to the extreme.
It sounded awful.
Oh, it is awful. So let's go to the psychologist's point of view for just a minute. So you went to a psychologist who does cognitive behavioral therapy. Have you heard of that, CBT?
No, uh-uh.
That's what I would recommend, and I'll tell you why. So cognitive behavioral therapy is not looking, I don't want to tell you what it doesn't look at, because there are a whole bunch of therapies that it's not involved with. But it really is a therapy whereby it's a desensitization-type therapy. It's used in a whole bunch of things besides desensitization, where you take your mind and you try to put it somewhere else. So people, for instance, who have agoraphobia, who have a fear of enclosed spaces, and a variety of other things, often will engage in CBT for 8-10 visits, 12 visits, 14 visits, where they actually look at situations that bother them, like heights, as I said, being in confined spaces. And then they work out a way whereby they talk themselves through mentally as they're going through that. It can be very effective. It's effective for people now with sleep disorders. We're starting to use it more and more with chronic pain. That's number 1, 2, and 3, because what you have to do is you have to get your mindset first and have confidence that this is not going to happen, because you're going through this, you know, this whole spiral of situations. Now, the second question is, when you actually get your blood drawn, I'm more interested in the blood and the shots, because are you getting piercings all the time? Piercings are kind of an elective issue.
No.
So it's really blood work and shots. Are you fasting in the morning when you do it? Have you had breakfast in the morning? Does that make a difference?
It does not make a difference. I'm 27 now, and there's only been two times it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, every finger prick, mm-hmm. blood drawn, it's always happened. Okay. So
you need cognitive behavioral therapy. That's what you need. Where basically they do simulations of what is going to happen and what's going on, and you get sort of up to it. Picture it as if you're afraid of heights. You know, the simulation, if you can picture it in your mind, it's kind of getting closer and closer to that banister to look down, but you're not looking down, and eventually you begin to try to relearn that. You clearly have to relearn something. I think there is something. I disagree with the other doctors when they say there's nothing you can do. Quite the contrary. I think there's something you can do, and I think CBT is the way to start. You've had the workup. So we know there's no seizures going on. So we know that is not the issue.
Okay. CBT. I appreciate it.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Good luck.
I'm looking it up now.
Let us know what happens. You've got to find somebody near your place that you can do. There's somebody who does that, I am sure of
that. She's in Nashville, so that's a place.
Oh, Nashville's a great place. Lots of good doctors in Nashville. Lots of good clinicians, too. So good luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We appreciate the call. Thanks so much for calling. You're going to really laugh at me, or else hit me.
Yeah.
Every now and then, I pop an Alprazolam, and I'm just like zoned out. Yeah. Really? Yeah. This wouldn't work for her.
No, I don't think that would work for her. No, I don't think it's that kind of an issue. It's very different. This is an automatic response that she really doesn't have control over. I don't think the Alprazolam would work.
I've never been a doctor, and I never will be again.
Yeah, that's right. But that's okay. Alprazolam, I don't think it would work. Right. And then you'd have that on board in addition to this sort of seizure-like response, and that might make things more complex. But Tom, Dr. Tom, thank you.
800.
Send the next question to Tom.
800-462-7413. So, Zorba, walking, stretching, dancing, what's the best for the brain?
Yeah, well, first of all, the best exercise you can do, I always say, is any exercise that you will do.
Yeah.
So I think that's a biggie. It's kind of an interesting study. I think it has some interesting usefulness. They basically scan the brain. In scans of the brain, we do that all the time. People who are senior citizens and older, 174 people in their 60s and 70s, no signs of cognitive impairment. Scanned them again 6 months later, looked around. These brain scans were MRI scans. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, something was sort of worrisome. And according to the scans, it looked like there was actually some changes that occurred in the brain that wasn't good. They weren't lighting up the way they thought they should light up. People still didn't show any signs of dementia. Mm-hmm. So first off, I begin to wonder, what are these scans measuring? In other words, they notice a difference 6 months later. Is the brain really deteriorating every 6 months in a 60-year-old or a 70-year-old? If that's the case, we'll be out of luck. Or SOL, as the phrase may be.
Yes.
But I think still the study still has some interest. What they found was the degeneration was the worst in people who were sedentary before joining the study. And that kind of makes sense.
Sure.
That would be the worst. But they found that dancing seemed to make the degeneration less, and in some people it actually seemed to improve their brains.
Really?
According to the scan. And so the question was, what's the difference between dancing and stretching, dancing and doing aerobic exercise? Although it is aerobic when you're dancing. I mean, there is some stretching and there's some aerobic. And the question is, maybe at least what they were doing based on neuronal activity is when you're dancing, you're trying to engage in movements and you're trying to go, am I supposed to go left? Am I supposed to go right? Think about exercise. It's repetitive. Bum, 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 bum.
Doing
the treadmill.
Yeah, you're right.
Or you're
the
doing
brain,
the elliptical.
Yeah.
Psh, psh, yeah. Psh, psh, yeah. Psh, psh, psh. And when doing stretching, you're doing, you know, you're doing that stretching. But when you're dancing, you're kind of smiling, you're happy, and you're trying to remember, is it the right leg or the left leg?
Yeah.
Is it this way or that way? And you're kind of using your brain more. And so even though I think the scans themselves do not show that our brains are degenerating every 6 months, I think it's kind of interesting to show a difference between the different exercises. And I think, once again, it goes to something that I've been thinking about for a long time, that the brain is a muscle. Use it or lose it. And so if you're not using your brain in a variety of ways, it does degenerate more, or at least you're not making new connections, which will help sort of go around the degeneration.
Interesting.
Now, Tom, you don't use a computer very much at all. Right?
What? The what?
The what. That's exactly right. But I always think about the fact that if I'm on Windows and I want to print, I can hit Control P, or I can hit the print icon on the top, or I can go to File, have a drop down to the print icon, and hit print. There are three or four ways at least that I can print something on my Windows, on a Windows PC. The same goes for a Mac. And so when the brain is working, if we have different ways of getting to different information, it's much better. In other words, there are different roads. When you dance, you're looking for different ways. Oh, I've got to move that right leg this way and the left foot up and that. And you're just exercising those neurons, and that's what we're measuring.
Do you and Penny dance?
I like to dance. Penny's never liked to dance. Among other things, because she looks at me and she says, you're a horrible dancer. So I think that's one of the reasons. And if you look at weddings where they take pictures where I'm dancing, you know what? She's absolutely right. Well, so we do not dance. You and Monica, do you dance?
Well, we take a nice romantic vacation each year on a Caribbean island, and we dance.
And you dance?
Yes.
Oh, how do you like it?
I love it, but that's the only time we dance.
Well, why do you only dance on a Caribbean island? Why don't you just go to a Caribbean bar?
Well, There are reasons that I won't go into that. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Bonnie's Ferry, Idaho. Hi.
Hello, hello.
How can we help?
I have a question about the use of ibuprofen. I have some arthritis in my right knee. I'll be 67 just in a couple of weeks. And I just want another opinion. I saw an orthopedic surgeon earlier on this winter because it was really hurting and I wondered what was going on. I've had arthroscopic surgery on both of my knees, but my right knee was really bugging me. Anyway, so I saw the orthopedic surgeon. He gave me three different options, basically, what I could do, one of which was, if I could tolerate the pain, just to treat it with ibuprofen, which I've used over the years. I've been an athlete most of my life, so I've used ibuprofen for sprained ankles and so on and so forth earlier on. And then I got kind of a little nervous about it because of all the other information that I've heard about ibuprofen, haven't used it forever. Anyway, he recommended, he said, if you can and can tolerate the pain, you can use 800 milligrams of ibuprofen three times a day. And my question to him was, is that safe to use? He assured me, in his opinion, that it was, providing I made sure that my stomach was always full. I had eaten, take it with a full glass of water, et cetera, and only take it when was necessary. I then asked another physician that I knew the same question, just because I wanted to get their opinion on it, and they seemed to give me basically the same information. So what I am asking is, I'm hoping to live to be 100 if I get real lucky. If that's the case, what happens to ibuprofen in dosages like this over time? That's what I'm really concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So the questions are very good questions. You know, how much, first of all, what is the dose that you take? So 800 milligrams three times a day, maximal dose of ibuprofen. I used to recommend that all the time for people with arthritis. Take it three times a day. Don't get arthritic pain. Just take it all the time. Now I recommend things a little differently. I say take it if you need it. Don't take it every day if you don't need it every day. I have a different issue with it. I think it is a relatively safe drug. That's the word, relatively. Can it bother you? Well, kind of depends. If your kidneys are good, it's not going to bother you. If your kidneys are not good, if you have diabetes, high blood pressure that's not controlled, a cardiovascular disease, that might produce a problem there. So there are issues. Does it cause kidney failure? No, it doesn't cause kidney failure. Does it cause GI distress? Yes. Does food make a difference? A little bit of food. I think if you don't get an upset stomach, I don't think you have to take it on a full stomach. I don't think that really has been shown to really make a difference. We know that it does affect the stomach, and for some people, taking it with food in their stomach really does. It really does matter. So your question is, over time, is this the right drug to take? And the answer is yes, but the dosage may change. So often with people in their 80s, I'll say, does 200 milligrams work? Try it out. And if they go, doesn't do much, I'll say, take 400 milligrams, try that out. And often in your 80s, you might only need 400 milligrams for what you need now in your 60s, because in your 80s, you may not be doing as much as you are in your 60s. So I hope that answers your question. I think they're relatively good drugs. I prescribe it all the time. And when I ache and I have aches, I take ibuprofen or I take naproxen, and I do it willy-nilly.
Well, that certainly answers my question.
Good luck. Keep moving.
Oh, don't worry about that. I will.
Okay.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite do-gooders and backseat drivers, the Grammar Police.
You know, Tom, as long as this is not about the Oxford comma, which has gotten lots of press lately, I am willing to listen.
Well, this one, I think, is from a listener who may have misheard something, because I don't think...
Oh, the Grammar Police, they never mishear anything.
Well,
they are the prigs, P-R-I-G-S, the prigs.
You listen to this.
Notice it's prig of our society.
I get it. This from a listener named Cristobal. He writes, "Dear Tom and Zorba, the good doctor said... you do not need to increase your thyroid to get rid of weight loss. I kept thinking, get rid of weight loss, what does that mean? That people are trying to get rid of the weight they already lost, or are they trying to get rid of a diet or product named weight loss? Please clarify what this semantic gem means. And P.S., for the nth time, tacos don't need taco seasoning." That would be like saying sandwich seasoning or cereal seasoning. A taco is a warm tortilla, soft or fried, filled with meat or vegetables, or a combination of both.
Holy cow.
That is it.
Taco seasoning, taco seasoning, taco seasoning.
Well, but what about the first
one? No, I think, I don't remember the exact call they're talking about. Back in the 50s. In order to get people to lose weight, they used to give people thyroid pills. They'd say, let's rev up your thyroid to get you to lose weight. They gave them Digitalis and thyroid pills. And my old partner, Frank Dukershine, who has since passed away, told me that's what they would do. They would get people, they would say, oh, you want to lose weight? Your thyroid must be sluggish. We didn't have a good way of measuring low thyroid in those days.
Yeah.
And so you're overweight, and not as many people are overweight, by the way. We'll give you thyroid. And so they would give them thyroid medication, and they would lose weight, but it wasn't healthy. It wasn't the right way to lose weight. And so I think that's really what this came from. It came from thyroid medication is not necessary unless you have a low thyroid. In other words, your thyroid is not producing enough hormone, in which case it is necessary. And then you only take the amount that's within the right range. You don't give yourself too much so that you're hyperthyroid, in which case you'll lose weight, but it's a bad way to lose it.
Did you hear Zorba misspeak on the show? Join the ever more emboldened Grammar Police by posting on our Facebook page or sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our special guest recipe is coming up. That's next. More of your calls, of course. Quacking Up with Zorba later. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time again, Zorba, and this week we're in for quite a treat. Today we have a special guest author joining in on the fun. Amy Kaneko is a self-described American woman married to a Japanese guy, and I love to cook and eat. Her book, Let's Cook Japanese Food, includes recipes compiled with the help of her in-laws, co-workers, and friends in Japan. And she joins us today to share with us her healthy Japanese recipe for salmon teriyaki. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love this cookbook, Let's Cook Japanese Food. Beautiful front cover. Well, how long did it take you to write this? This is obviously a labor of love.
It absolutely is, because I worked so hard with my friends and my family in Japan to put the recipes together. So there's nothing better than having a book of your own family's recipes that you can cook from every day. It took about, I don't know, maybe 2 years to put everything together and to bring it to fruition.
Well, first you've got to do the recipes, but then the pictures in the book are outrageously great, and you've got to write the recipes, test them out. We're going to do one of the recipes, salmon teriyaki. I love salmon. So let's look at the marinade first of all. So I'm going to go through it. You start out with a 1/4 cup soy sauce. What soy sauce should our listeners get?
Well, you're in Wisconsin, right?
We have grocery stores in Wisconsin. We don't just have cheese. We don't just have milk and yes. We have grocery stores. We actually have, in Madison, we have a number of Asian grocery stores.
You actually have in Wisconsin one of the major manufacturing facilities for Kikkoman.
Right, Kikkoman. In Lake Geneva.
Yes, exactly. And that is naturally brewed soy sauce, which is the kind to get.
Excellent.
Except no substitutes.
Easy to get. A tablespoonful of sugar. Mirin. Yeah. We can find mirin in a lot of grocery stores, certainly in an Asian grocery store.
Yes, and you can also order it online. And even some liquor stores possibly will carry mirin because it is sweetened rice wine.
Oh, you know, that is an excellent idea. A big liquor store would have that because that's where you have to go for the sake.
And about sake, you want to know that you can buy the cheapest bottle they have. It does not matter. My sake, I think, was like $5 a bottle, and it works just fine.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed when I go to a Japanese restaurant, there is very expensive sake and there is inexpensive sake. And because I don't notice the difference and I don't have the tongue for that, it tastes the same to me, but there's a difference in the price, in the bill, when the bill comes due.
Well, that's good. You're a cheap date then.
I am a cheap date. That's right. My wife would say the same thing. And then 4 skin-on salmon fillets, about 6 ounces each, and a tablespoonful of canola or another neutral oil. So no olive oil in this case, a neutral oil.
Right, because olive oil will give it a flavor that is not necessarily relative to this recipe.
Relative to this. Okay, let's make the recipe. So to make the marinade, in a small bowl, stir together the soy sauce, sugar, mirin, and sake until the sugar is dissolved. Then rub your fingers over the fish fillet to check for the pin bones. Very good point, because when you have the fillets, you don't want to have those pin bones in there. Removing them with a needle nose pliers or pulling them with your fingertips. Do you have a special pliers for this in your kitchen?
I also make jewelry as a hobby, so I have needle nose pliers.
I was wondering.
I do use them.
I have to tell you, when I read this, I thought to myself, who in their kitchen has a needle nose plier? The answer is a jewelry maker. So pat the fillets with paper towels, put them in a single layer on a shallow pan, pour the marinade over the fillets, coat them evenly, cover and marinate in the refrigerator just for about a half an hour. That's all it needs then, right? Not longer than that. Then in a large frying pan over medium heat, warm the oil when it's hot. So how would our listeners know that it's the right temperature? Because that is an issue with oil.
Well, you definitely don't want to get it hot enough to smoke. This is a medium heat, so you probably don't want to stick your finger in it to test it either. What I do is I normally drip a little bit of the sauce into the pan.
Okay.
And when I see that bubble a little bit, then I realize it's hot enough to put the fish in.
Okay, that's perfect. How long, when you make this, do you wait before you put the salmon in?
Well, if I'm heating it over medium, then I usually wait probably about 5 minutes on my stove.
Okay.
And I have a gas stove. It takes about 5 minutes.
So that, I think that is a very, very important point. So in a large frying pan, medium heat, warm the oil. And once again, 4 to 5 minutes depending. Don't get it smoky. When the oil is hot, remove the fillets from the marinade. Reserve the marinade and add to the pan. Cook it until it's medium brown on both sides. 3 minutes on one side. Carefully turn it 2 minutes longer until it's light brown, watching the glaze clinging to the fillet so it does not burn. Reduce the heat to medium-low if necessary. Pour the reserved marinade over the fish. gently shaking the pan to distribute the sauce evenly over the fish. Cook until the sauce is reduced to a syrup. I love that. Tom's mouth is now watering.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
It's now watering, and the fish is dark brown. 1 to 2 minutes longer, transfer to a pan and serve. I love it. Absolutely
right,
great.
And what that does is it makes the sauce kind of a caramel almost, with a little bit of a salty caramel, which is a great flavor. And it's not like, you know, I think sometimes if you go to restaurants here, you'll find a teriyaki and it has like a big glop of sauce on it, which looks bad and doesn't really taste that great either. This is like a beautiful, sweet, salty glaze that just maps the fish and it looks so pretty and it tastes really good, and it keeps it healthier, too, I think.
I think you're right. I think it. And I like the tip about making sure that it's about 4 to 5 minutes medium heat until that oil is warm enough, which really does make a difference. And I will have to get some needle nose pliers for my kitchen.
I'll send you a pair.
Thank you. Thanks, man. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Wonderful cookbook. Let's Cook Japanese Food by Amy Kaneko. Absolutely wonderful. Where in Colorado do you live now?
I live in Boulder. Town.
Beautiful town. Yeah, my son went to the University of Colorado. I was there numerous times. Great town. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Amy. And if you'd like a copy of today's recipe, visit our website
at zorbapastor.org. Don't forget, you'll find lots of things on that website. Great pictures of Tom. You should see those photos. Unbelievable photos of Tom and all different, you know, photos that you will like, and also other recipes that you like at zorbapastor.org.
They have actually a photo of George Clooney with my name underneath it. Now, Zorba, back to the phones, welcoming a listener in Highland, New York. Hi.
Hello, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
So I play drums, and this is going to make sense in a second, but all of a sudden, grip strength in my right hand is just feeling like it's not there anymore, and I've noticed that when somebody shakes my hand, if they squeeze, I get a pain that goes right into my elbow, and the only thing I can think of is that I've been playing percussion for 25 years, and off and on, but playing it a lot more than usual, and I am basically hitting a hunk of brass with a wooden stick, you know, 16,000 times a night. And I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. So it's just weird. It will hurt every now and then, but it's when somebody shakes my hand, I have no grip strength, and man, does it hurt. And even to the point where I've gone like, ow, when somebody shakes my hand, and it's weird.
What kind of band are you in?
It's just a cover band. So it's anywhere from just simple rock stuff to more technical progressive, like, you know, Rush or Pink Floyd or anything like that. Uh-huh.
16,000 times a night. It's an interesting.
Well, I mean, if you're doing 16th notes over a 5-minute song, I mean, you're just hitting a hunk of brass over and over again.
Yeah, you're doing factory work. That's what it is. I mean, it's factory work.
Just a little prettier, though.
You may not think of it as factory work, but boy, is it factory work. But it is repetitive. That's exactly what it is. It's this repetitive movement that you're doing all the time over and over again, which is undoubtedly causing an extensor tendonitis in the forearm. And the forearm muscles are the main muscles that we actually use to grip. It's the forearm muscles that really give us the strong grip that's there. So does this happen? What about when you're actually using it, you know, when you're hitting it? And you're hitting the brass.
It doesn't hurt. It's the weirdest thing. It doesn't hurt when I'm doing it. It's the handshake that gets me every time. And it's when they squeeze that muscle in there. Whew,
and that's when it occurs. Well, one of the things I would try to do, go to the web and look for extensor tendonitis exercises. Tendonitis exercises. They're things that you do with these things called, they're rubber bands. They're actually not rubber bands, but they're things you can get from your doctor or physical therapist that look like rubber is what they are. You can also buy them on the web, and I'm blocking on the name of it, but basically use them for isometric activities. And what you do is you can do a series of exercises to rehab those muscles. That's what I would start with. I would start with that. Because generally what happens with our muscles, if we do an exercise program beyond which we're using our muscles, okay, beyond, in other words, our muscles are stronger than we have to use them. When we start to use those muscles, we have reserve because our muscles can go stronger because we've gotten into the habit of training them to be stronger. And what I think you want to do in a case like what you have is you want to take those muscles that you have and strengthen them up a little bit because you're using them all the time in the factory work that you're doing. day in and day out in the musical factory work. And that's where I would hit. You know, obviously, you're not going to take ibuprofen and Aleve all the time because you've got to shake somebody's hand. But the handshake is very important because you want to give a handshake back that is strong, right? I mean, you don't want to have a weak handshake when somebody shakes your hand.
Yeah, it's weird when I meet somebody and I go, ow.
No, it is very
it's a weird first impression because it hurts.
Oh, yeah. And I have to tell you something interesting. I just got back from Utah Public Radio. Wonderful people at UPR. Absolutely great people. They showed me a marvelous time. We did some fundraising activities. I skied a day at Beaver Mountain, which was awesome. Went around to a number of little small hospitals and communities. And one of the things I noticed, and I mentioned it after about 2 days or 3 days, the people in Utah give strong handshakes, stronger than the people in Wisconsin. You know, there's a certain amount of strength to your handshake. And when somebody, shook my hands the first time or second time, I thought in my mind, gosh, that guy has a strong handshake. And then a woman gave me a handshake, and I thought, gosh, she has a strong handshake. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, is this because I have a weak handshake? And I mentioned it to the people. And they said it was part of the culture of Utah for a whole bunch of reasons, has to do with the LDS Church and the mission work that they do, that giving a strong handshake is what children learn in school.
They're happy to see out-of-staters more happy than we are in Wisconsin.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they're happy to meet out-of-staters. But I mention this because the handshake is important. And returning the handshake in a strong way. You know, it's amazing. It's an amazing, important part of our culture. Because if you shake somebody's hand and it's weak, you notice it. It has to be kind of equivalent, you know, in a handshake.
Yeah.
It's a subtle cue. Extensor tendonitis exercises. Let us know. It's called TheraBands. The more I thought about it, the more it came into mind.
Yeah, I wrote that down. I'll definitely
TheraBands,
check it out.
And you can buy them on the web all over the place.
Well, I have no doubt you left a legacy with me because I think I'm going to call my drum set the factory. I think that's a good name for a drum set. I'm going to work.
Working for the man. Working for the man.
Yeah, I love it. Hey, thanks for your help.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And before the break, Zorba, time now for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
A listener named Peter in Chicago, Illinois, recently sent us a neatly typed and hand-signed letter. We typically get emails at the show, but we always appreciate the effort that goes into sending your thoughts via good old-fashioned snail mail. So here's what Peter wrote. Dear Dr. Zorba, on a recent show, you went way too easy on homeopathy. The premise of homeopathy, as you accurately describe, is contrary to everything we've known for 100 years about chemistry and biology. A 2010 review of studies by the independent Cochrane Collaboration concludes that homeopathic medicine has no effect beyond placebo. I understand that you wanted to be sensitive to people who derive a placebo benefit from their delusion, but people with serious medical conditions are wasting money on useless concoctions rather than seeking real evidence-based medical treatment. This quibble notwithstanding, I enjoy and appreciate your show. Keep up the good work.
Well, first of all, great criticism. I think that is a great criticism. On the other hand, standard allopathic regular medicine does not have all the answers. You know, when it comes to things like chronic fatigue, chronic pain, we don't have all the answers. And sometimes we do more harm than good, me included, in terms of the overuse of opioids. And I'm one of those people who overused opioids just like a lot of other doctors. So it's not as if evidence-based medicine answers everything because we don't have the evidence for everything. Now, homeopathy has, I think the placebo effect is very, very important. But there's some people who take homeopathic cures and they go, I feel great. So am I going to look at them and say, this is not working? You really shouldn't feel great because it's the placebo effect.
Yeah.
You know, there's an art in medicine, just like there's an art in everything else. And I subscribe to the art of medicine as much as the science of medicine. That's why we call it the medical arts.
Interesting. When do we call it that?
Well, I kind of made it up at this point. Oh, okay. So I thought about it. But it actually is called the medical arts. That's what it's called. It's called the medical arts. In some places. You mean, where do we have to? I'd have to Google it, Tom, and I don't have that. I'll leave that to you if you can find a computer.
Do you disagree with the good doc? Feel free to send us a handwritten letter, like Peter in Chicago, or you can always post it to our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research, important research to talk about. More of your calls, of course. We'll be quack, quack, quacking up with Dr. Zorba, too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, juices and obesity.
Right. So we have to talk about juice. Juice is good in moderate amounts. Juice is bad in large amounts. So there really has been a whole movement in many sectors about fruit juice because kids, especially young kids, will say, and parents will say, hey, I'm drinking 20 ounces of fruit juice. That's good for me. The answer is no. 20 ounces of fruit juice has as many calories as 20 ounces of Coca-Cola. Now, I'm not saying that fresh-squeezed Florida orange juice is the same as Coca-Cola. It's not. Fresh-squeezed orange juice is far, far more nutritious, but it still has the same number of calories, roughly 1 teaspoon of sugar per ounce of what you're eating. But I think we have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. Where do you think that ever came from, throwing out the baby? Whoever thought about throwing out a baby with the bathwater?
Well, because the baby's good and the bathwater is not. So,
that's
so,
right. But
so juice is
But
good.
Who would ever throw out a baby with the bathwater anyway? It wouldn't happen. But juice is good in modest amounts. And so this particular study looked at the fact that, excessive weight gain is a real issue, especially with kids under the age of 18. We've discovered that kids actually start to exercise less when they start to be about 8 or 9 years of age, not when they're teenagers, and that's part of it. They tend to sit around more when they're around 8 or 9, and when you sit around, you eat more. Mm-hmm. And when you eat more, you drink more. And when you drink more, if there's juice in the refrigerator, you may drink more juice. And so they specifically looked at whether or not there were changes in the BMI scores of children who drank a juice glass of juice every day. Now, do you remember, did your mother serve you juice in the morning?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how big was the juice glass?
Well, yeah, it was a small glass.
Well, they can't see what you're doing with your hand, Tom.
It's a small glass.
Small glass. Well, yeah,
put it up
to the radio.
Everybody knows what a juice glass looks like.
Put it up to the iPhone. It is a 6-ounce glass. Well, I don't know if everybody knows what a juice glass is. No. I disagree. I think most people don't know that a juice glass is a 6-ounce glass. Now, the adults
listening to the program. I drink orange juice out of the carton, by the way.
You are not supposed to say that, Tom. That is not allowed on the show. This is public radio. No one on public radio ever drinks juice, milk, or anything else directly out of the carton. They always pour it in a glass, neatly put it in a dishwasher, or wash it in the sink. But for those of you who actually are going to pour it into a glass, which is a better way to do it because then you can measure it, 6 ounces of juice are good. Now, I still believe that it's far better for you to go to the actual orange itself because I think it's better. But 6 ounces every day will give your kids lots of vitamin C, lots of nutrients. Make sure the size of the glass is noted and no refills.
800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener in Hartford, Wisconsin. Hi.
Yeah, Doc, this is an important question. I hope I'm not bothering you too much. On the power of attorney, when, let's say, a husband and wife scenario, if the husband is the power of attorney and the wife doesn't have dementia, she's as bright as can be, but they want to do a procedure at the hospital where she's at, mm-hmm. and they want to put a tube down her throat, which would terrify her mm-hmm. and probably cause her demise. Mm-hmm. Now,
Wait a minute. Stop right now. Why would a tube down her throat cause her demise?
That's what they wanted to, for whatever was wrong, they wanted to look down there with the tube through her throat, down mm-hmm. her throat.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want that done, but they went to the husband and said, no, no, we've got to look down. We've got to go with this procedure. Well, she died after that procedure.
Oh, that's terrible.
I mean, with the power of attorney, doesn't the person, the patient have the first say-so?
Well, let's talk about power of POA.
Mm-hmm.
Power of attorney is not activated unless two clinicians, two doctors, activate the power of attorney, and they have to look at the patient and say the patient has dementia. You know, they're not oriented into place and time, and they're supposed to do an evaluation. No one else has a power of attorney over you if you are cognizant. Now, do you know this situation that happened? Is this somebody who you know? Obviously, it's not you because you're alive. Is it somebody who you know?
Yes, it was a family member, and I was frightened of the whole scenario, and I called a bunch of doctors that I know.
Yeah.
They said, no, no, they've got to do that. They've got to put the tube down. They have to know what's what.
First of all, looking at it, whether or not they had to put the tube down or not, if the husband had power of attorney, was this a relative of yours or a friend
yes.
of yours? A relative of yours. So if they had power of attorney is not activated unless the person has dementia.
Well, then,
and
then
that person...
Then they didn't do it right then.
You bet. And
oh,
that person,
boy.
And you have a right to your own body. You have a right to say, no, I'm not going to have it done. And even if they say, we should look at it to see what's going on, you have a right to say, forget it. I don't want you to look at it. I don't want it done.
I wish I had talked to you before, honest.
Yeah,
boy.
Yeah, what a shame. How old was she?
62. Yeah.
Now, why would she have power of attorney at the age of 62? Had she had dementia beforehand or something?
No, she's smarter than anybody, honestly. No, she didn't have any of that.
What were they looking for? Do you have any idea?
I don't know what they're looking for. They didn't talk to her. They talked to the husband. They put pressure, the doctors, whatever, the nurses, on the husband saying, we have to do that. And he isn't terrific in medical procedures. He said, well, you know, whatever you have to do, do it, all of that.
But he did not have the power to make the decision for her unless she had dementia or Alzheimer's or something.
That.
So he did not have the ability to make that decision.
Well, I wish I'd have talked to you before, honest. Thanks, Doc.
Thanks.
For your
you
help.
Take care. Yeah,
thanks. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, let's take another dive now into the murky waters of medical quackery. It's time again for Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, what can you tell us about tuberculosis and maggots?
Yeah, maggots, right. So, first of all, I want to tell you, maggots did have a place in medical care. They had a place in World War I, and they had a place in World War II, because they would put them on infected wounds. You remember World War II, penicillin was not discovered until the very end of World War II. And I had a patient of mine who was a nurse, and she said they had maggots in a jar, and they would put it on the wounds to eat up the debris, debride the wound, and help. But That being aside, this was totally different. This was putrefied turkey meat and beef meat that was filled with maggots. And the idea was for tuberculosis to inhale the gases from maggot sheds in order to clear the lungs and cure it of tuberculosis. And the idea is that you would have these maggot sheds all over the place, and patients would go out into the maggot sheds, and they would inhale the putrefying meat and the smell of maggots. And doesn't it sound wonderful? In order to get rid of tuberculosis, but it was interesting because this guy Bryant, who basically was doing the maggot thing, he said it really helped cure his tuberculosis. He was called the Maggot King of England. because he was going around all over the place recommending maggot smells and putrefying things. Nonetheless, this is quackery. So anyone who tells you to breathe in the smell of petrifying animals and maggots, you tell them that Dr. Zorba says this is quackery and you're not going to do it. And here we are. We'll put this in the dustbin of history.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org, or don't forget Facebook.
Let's get back to the phones now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413, as we welcome a listener in Grafton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. I have a concern of using gummy multivitamins. Mm-hmm. Are they worth the cost? My prior vitamins had a hard shell around the pill.
Uh-huh.
Don't the gummies start breaking down in the mouth when you're chewing, mm-hmm. as it is instructed on the bottle, and lose their benefits before they get down to the stomach?
Well,
or wherever
great
they're
question.
Breaking down.
Well, yeah, but really before like I question it, do you like gummy bears? Is that why you bought gummy vitamins?
I take them at work. And I had to run over and get coffee or water. Uh-huh. So I just pop them maybe about 2 or 3 times a day.
Uh-huh. I thought maybe your mommy was giving you the gummy vitamins.
Well, she advised me to take them.
Your mother advised you to take gummy vitamins. Well, I don't want to make fun of people who eat gummy vitamins. No, my wife takes gummy multivitamins because she doesn't like swallowing a big pill. They don't break down if you chew them. It doesn't break down because you have vitamins in your food, and you chew vitamins in your food, and they don't break down. So the chemicals are there, and they won't break down. But no, you can chew your vitamins. I would not recommend chewing vitamin capsules because they'd probably break your teeth. They're pretty hard. So
because it's reading, I'm reading it to a gummy, and you get 100% of your vitamins, a C, D, E, B.
How many? How many
two.
Bears?
Two only
bears?
Two.
That's all you need. Then that's all you need. You only need two bears. Two bears a day will keep the doctor away. Tom liked that. He's laughing. It wasn't much of a laugh, but thank you for
your
call. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thanks.
Yep, we appreciate the call. Thank you so much. And before we head out, Zorba, we love it when our listeners post on our Facebook page, so we scooped up a few of these questions and comments and would like to share them with you in a segment we call Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
I like that. You know something? You know, I have to tell you, the producer, the director, the engineer, the show, the people behind the screen, you know, behind the curtain that you never see, they are so creative. And I have to tell you, that particular music I have not heard in the past. But if I have heard it, I don't remember it. I love it. I think they actually popped their mouth like this when they were doing it.
Carl's a musician, you know.
I know that. I know that. I can tell.
Okay.
Brad. He's a musician.
Well, that's right.
That's right. The people behind the glass are musicians. Yeah. You're a musician. You play the French horn.
Used to.
And when I was 9 years old, I played the accordion. Maybe you should bring your French horn in one day, and I'll play my accordion, and then we could do it with the real musicians and see what it sounds like.
Nobody wants to hear my French horn.
And let me tell you something. Nobody wants to hear my accordion.
Let's get to it. Kermit from Wisconsin wants to clear up something you said recently, Zorba. You said that copper in pots and pans was reputed to have caused dementia during the Roman Empire. I had always heard speculation that it was lead in pipes and cookware that caused the problem. Is there also an issue with copper that I had not previously heard of, or did you mean to refer to lead?
No, I actually meant to refer to copper. Lead may be the issue. That is an issue with the Roman Empire. But some thought that it might be the way they actually used copper, elements of copper, and the way they cooked and the way they drank out of copper. Mm-hmm. So that might be the issue. But thanks for bringing that up, Kermit. Lead is really, and it's still an issue.
From a listener named Sharon. How do we know if our herbal supplements contain what they say on the label?
Well, that's a very good question. What's the next question? The answer is we don't. The feds regulate them like they regulate cosmetics. So if you put something on your face and it says it'll make you look 10 years younger, do you really think it'll make you look 10 years younger? And what's in there? The feds regulate supplements the way they regulate cosmetics, and you don't know if anything is in it. That's why I like to go to consumerlab.com or consumerlab.com. consumerlab.org. Either way, it'll get you to the right website. Pay your $25 a year, and they test the supplements. And if you're going to take a supplement, take one that's tested, or go to Consumer Reports in your library. Yes, we do have libraries. Go to your library, Consumer Reports, and look at their Nature's Edition. And again, do the only the ones that they actually test. That's what I believe.
You and I look 10 years younger.
Absolutely.
Without any supplements.
I've been using Nivea cream, and I can't believe what it does to my face.
Now, Greg from Idaho shared the following sleep advice with us. On a recent show, you mentioned sleeping outside. My wife and I have not slept inside for the last 10 years.
Try doing that in Madison, Wisconsin, and see how it works.
We have a screened sleeping porch that we enjoy year-round here in the mountains of northern Idaho. Wow. It's good for your health. It toughens you up, so to speak. I think we've gotten soft when I think about our ancestors who thrived in the worst climate ever, the Pleistocene Ice Age. So my advice is to move the bed outside.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
He's 100% correct. We are much softer than they are. However, let us not forget that in the Pleistocene Age, they often died at about 35 to 40. They did not live very long in the old times. They didn't. And actually, in 1900, the average age of death was 49. So although they were tough, they died young. So I'm not exactly sure. Now, the other question is, I can't imagine in Madison, Wisconsin, or in the mountains of Idaho, actually sleeping on a porch in the wintertime. So you know what? These people are tough. More power to them.
Very tough. Very tough. And finally, Zorba, Connie in Wisconsin Dells shared our page with her friends and wrote the following. I love this guy. He's like Wisconsin's Dr. Oz.
Oh, how nice is that? Thank you so much. Dr. Oz is a friend of mine. I'll have to pass that on to him and see if he likes it because he's like Dr. Pastor. I doubt it. Thank you.
Let's keep those Facebook comments coming, and you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.